This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show, your home for open, honest, and provocative conversations.
Hey everyone, I'm Megyn Kelly. Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show, which we are styling today, a show about guns in America. This is one of our signature debate shows, and today we are going to take a deep dive into one of the most divisive issues in America, guns. While the majority of gun owners are responsible, we are also all too familiar with the tragedies involving firearms. And we are going to have a thoughtful, fact-based conversation today to help get you educated on what's real and what's not, and what are, if any, gun reforms that could actually help prevent future mass shootings, or in particular, teenagers or people who are not mentally well from getting their hands on guns and using them against innocent victims. We're going to talk about whether there are real solutions that we as a nation can agree on. We have brought together two of the best minds on gun rights and gun control. Both men have broken countless stories while covering the gun beat. Stephen Gutowski is founder of The Reload, and Mike Spees is a senior writer for The Trace. Stephen and Mike, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Megyn.
All right. So, Stephen, you are The Reload is, I don't know. I don't want to say pro-gun exactly, but just for the audience to understand, Stephen, you're more sort of on the pro-gun. And Mike, you're more on sort of the gun control beat and focused on what measures we could take to sort of roll back some of the problems we've been seeing. So let's just kick it off with this. Some stats for the audience. We, according to what I read, we had more than 45,000 people shot to death in America in 2020. we had a spike in violence in 2021. And the vast majority of those gun deaths were suicide. So it's not all homicide, but a fair amount of homicide too. And America is the biggest gun country in the world. And in particular, what keeps people talking about it is the mass shootings. Right. Like what we saw in Michigan, this kid, Ethan Crumbly, going into the school and shooting, other teenagers. His parents have now been arrested. It's a fascinating case. But we also see it when innocent civilians or police officers are shot to death by people who had no business having guns or the kind of gun that they had. And that's where I'll kick it off, because here in New York, overnight, the second police officer died who was shot by the 44-year-old suspect. He also died. The suspect has died since. But these cops were called to this house in Harlem by the suspect's mom. They were walking down the hallway to go into his room and see what was wrong. And he came out. They didn't stand a chance. He came out guns blazing, shot the cops, both of whom are now dead. One was 22. He was shot and killed. And now we have, and his name, by the way, was Jason Rivera. And then there's Wilbert Mora. Just 27. It's so awful. It's just so awful. And Stephen, I'll start with you. As somebody who is used to sort of defending gun rights, a lot of people looked at that modification he had on his gun, which I understand was not lawful. I don't know that that was the reason the cops died. You know, he could have shot him just without that modification. But should that guy have had a gun, career criminal? And is there a gun law that could have prevented it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a lot to unpack with a situation like that, with domestic violence call that leads to, the death of law enforcement officers is a horrific tragedy. And obviously, I think most people would question, well, how could this happen? How can we prevent this going forward? And there are a number of ways. I mean, oftentimes in situations like that, what you'll find, and this is true for many mass shootings as well, some of the most famous ones that we know, the shooter was prohibited. They weren't legally allowed to own guns in the first place due to their either mental health history or their criminal history, such as in this case. And you know, the question is, how do you keep somebody who is already prohibited from owning guns in under federal law, so in the entire country, from obtaining them? And that's where a lot of the controversy comes in, because you know there's different proposals on that range from better enforcement.
All right, but let me just stop you there. Let me just stop you. Yeah. Forgive my interruption, but I want to make sure we all stay on same page. So he should not, this 44-year-old man, now dead, the shooter, mm-hmm. should not have had a gun. Why?
Well, he had a criminal history that included either a felony conviction or a misdemeanor domestic violence conviction, then he shouldn't have been able to obtain it, or at least he wouldn't legally have been able to possess the gun in the first place.
So we see it all the time, though, with criminals. We see it all the time with criminals who commit domestic violence or some other crime, some other felony. They get out of jail. It seems very easy. It seems very easy for them to get a gun. Am I wrong?
No. I mean, it can be very easy for people who are prohibited, people who are known criminals, to obtain guns illegally outside of the current, you know, system that we have in place to buy guns. You know, through licensed dealers with background checks involved. You know, there's obviously proposals to expand that system to private sales as well. That's where a lot of the controversy comes in with the so-called universal background checks, because the idea there is that private sales should also have to go through the background check system like sales from licensed dealers do. Although, of course, in this case, you're talking about New York, which has a law like that in place already. And obviously, a lot of criminals just don't comply with it. And they sell guns knowingly.
That's the problem. And this gets right to the heart of it right off the top, right? So it's like, Mike, we do have tough gun laws in New York City. And yet, there was this guy sitting with this gun with this unlawful modifier on it. Again, I don't think it wasn't the modifier that led to the death of the cops. A regular old gun could have killed these cops just as easily. But you know, the point is just how easy it is, despite the fact this is a career criminal sitting there with a gun. I don't know. I'd love a real solution. I would. I'm not. Yeah. I'm so open-minded on this issue. I've been the victim of a crime, and so I appreciate guns for with the good guys who protect us. But I have three kids, and I certainly worry about, you know, school shootings and the other stuff too. So I'd love to see a gun reform that could actually stop the bad guys from getting the guns. But we passed every single one of the gun reforms Joe Biden's pushing right now. That guy still would have had this gun.
Yeah, I think the problem across the board in America is that we're pretty weak on accountability measures, which is what fuels the illegal gun market. So, for example, one thing, and this in some ways also in a different way relates back to the Michigan shooting that you were talking about, is we have pretty poor storage laws and regulation, especially when it comes to firearms dealers. For example, it is as investigations have shown that the trace is done. There's no real requirement in federally licensed firearm dealers or places that sell guns to store them in such a way that they're not easily accessible, which is why these smash and grab situations where people basically just drive a car through the front door and take a hammer and break glass and remove all the weapons and run out, or saw a hole through the ceiling and drop in and take all the guns. Like it's a gaping hole in our system that allows legal guns to be trafficked into an illegal market. And I think until we're a lot more serious about regulating gun sellers, that's going to continue to be the pipeline. And
how
obviously
often
the
does
other
that happen?
Issue, which we haven't,
how,
I don't know if
how frequent an event is that, Mike, where people are doing this? We've been following the smash and grab of the Gucci bags, but often does that happen with respect to the guns?
Well, I wish I could give you like a good statistic on that. I mean, I think it's pretty, I mean, I think they're recognized as pretty easy targets, and definitely, you know, per the investigation that I was referencing, we have quite a lot of video showing the ease with which people were able to break into gun shops and steal a ton of weapons.
These are, this is certainly a phenomenon that happens. This is one way that criminals get their guns. Mike's correct on that point, but I would sort of question the idea that it's easy, because given the tactics that are often employed, like as Mike suggested there, literally crashing cars through buildings to get to the guns. I don't know what, you know, that adding an extra safe after you're willing to knock down the wall of a building to get to the guns is going to be much more of a deterrent in preventing these sorts of thefts.
One tactic. Sure. I don't mean it. I mean, maybe that, you know, referencing the car is sort of an extreme example. There are myriad ways in which people break into all manner of facilities, including gun shops. It is. I mean, there's never like a panacea, but in this case, I think another issue, right, when we're talking about like, how did this person get the gun? Another issue is we don't, trace data is not publicly available per the law, right, Stephen? So that's something that we can't.
What do you mean?
We until I believe was it like the 1980s or 1986, used to be able. It was the ATF was required to make trace data on guns public, so, which is to say that the public could assess or could see where a particular gun came from that showed up in a crime. Is that right, Stephen? Am I getting this right?
Right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. There used to be more granular data on exactly what stores sold, you know, how many guns that ended up being traced by the ATF. Of course, obviously, the industry counterpoint to this, and the reason that it's not done anymore, is because it doesn't imply necessarily that the stores are doing anything, you know, illegal or wrong, just because some of the guns eventually end up using crimes. This became a controversial thing. And that, you know, because basically just any gun store that was near a city would be labeled a bad apple gun dealer. And that was one of the reasons that happened.
The only reason I point to it is it just makes it more difficult to assess like trafficking patterns, which is to say it's not as if the ATF can't do it itself. But and we all know that federal agencies are usually fairly strapped, and like as a pro-public investigation recently showed with the EPA, they're not necessarily that great at utilizing their own data. But sometimes enterprising journalists, such as yourself or many others, given the opportunity to do that, you know, could potentially add an extra layer of protection or at least transparency when it comes to some of the questions that we're dealing with right now. What did it say? I think, you know, when it comes to a useful proposal, accountability seems to always be the best deterrent in my personal opinion. So, you know, when it comes to universal background checks, which are far from a panacea, I would totally agree with that and are sort of better than nothing, but don't even necessarily account for the most important, like,
all right, let's have an easy to understand discussion on the things that are being proposed and that get kicked around and that, you know, we know Joe Biden wants. He definitely wants universal or uniform background checks. So what does that mean, right? Don't we already have universal background checks? I don't know if you can call them universal, but background checks in most of the states, Stephen?
Yes. So under federal law, the way it works is there's a specific system that was built for commercial gun dealers. And so if you want to sell guns commercially, if you want to make a business out of selling firearms, you have to obtain a federal license from the federal government. And if you're selling a gun to somebody who is not similarly licensed, then you have to perform a background check. That's how the system was designed to work. It specifically targets commercial sales and does not regulate non-commercial sales. So used gun sales by just regular people who aren't selling their guns to make a profit or build a business around.
Now, just to give a practical example of that. So if I walk into a gun store in Connecticut, where I live now, and I say I want to buy a gun, they would do a background check on me. But if I went to my neighbor who I knew had guns and said, can I buy your handgun from you, your pistol? She could sell it to me and I wouldn't have to go through any sort of a check and it would be a lawful sale.
Well, not in Connecticut because they have state laws that deal with this as well on top of the federal regulations. But in Virginia, where I live, Virginia also just recently passed this. But Pennsylvania, where I'm from, That would be the case. Yes. If you're within state limits, if you went to buy a handgun, now handguns have also added regulations on top of them. You can't buy them across state lines without going through a licensed dealer first, even used guns. So there's a lot of sort of complication that goes into this stuff. But your example would be accurate in a state that doesn't have a universal background check law in place, which is, to be clear, the vast majority of states in the United States.
So the vast majority of states would require a background check even in a private sale?
Would not.
Yeah, would not. Yeah. It's just a commercial sale. Okay, and when they do the background check on me, what are they mainly looking for? Whether I've committed a crime or I'm on some sort of a, you know, if it's a state that has a red flag law, I've been red flagged for some mental deficiency or risk?
Yeah, so under the federal system, what they're looking for is whether or not you've committed a felony, so a crime that's punishable by over a year in prison. Or a domestic violence misdemeanor. And there's, we can talk about this later, but there's some controversy over what exactly constitutes a domestic violence misdemeanor. So people want to change the definition there. Or if you've been adjudicated mentally ill as a threat to yourself or others, through which is really a legal process as well. And those are the main prohibited
persons. What if I were adjudicated mentally ill
justice
5 years ago, but now I'm fine? You know, because you see this like a young man who, when he hits 20, has a schizophrenic outbreak. He's showing signs of being threatening. And so let's say he gets a 2-month commitment and that's been documented. But now it's 5 years later. He's 25. He hasn't had any other issues. Would that prevent him from getting a gun?
It would, unless he has had his rights restored in some way, which is a process you can go through. It's pretty arduous, but
would it,
it's possible.
Would it prevent him forever?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, forevermore. Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, that is not one area in which I am pro-gun at all. I feel like if you've shown signs of having, especially one of the mental illnesses that we know are often linked to gun crimes, you are one of the few who's not going to get a gun. And I mean, as a country with over 400 million guns, sorry, not everyone can have one. Certain things preclude you. And those people are on the list, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. So that's the background check. So how many states then, you tell me, Mike, how many states are more like Pennsylvania, where it's like, well, the feds can do what they want, but if you want to have a private sale inside of our state, go for it. We don't need any background check for you.
I don't have the number on hand, but as we were saying, it's definitely the majority. And I think in states that have tried, you know, more purplish states like Nevada that have, well, for instance, Nevada is a good example, right? In the wake of that horrible mass shooting there, at the music festival, they, through a ballot measure, I believe, the citizens of the state of Nevada passed a background check law, and then the attorney general refused to enforce it by arguing that privates, like, by, it was effectively unenforceable. How could you enforce the law? Like, how could you require people to conduct background checks if they're not licensed dealers.
Right. Like, how would my neighbor, who I love, be said, like, what database would she be looking at to figure out whether I was a criminal or had a mental health issue?
Well, so the way most of these state laws work, and if I remember correctly, I believe there's only 8 states. Actually, it's probably more like, I think it's like 10 now that have passed universal background checks at the state level.
Yeah, I was gonna say a dozen,
it's somewhere around. It's not a big majority, although they do tend to be very large population states like California, New York, Massachusetts, you know. So it's a lot of people live under this sort of regulation already. But the way it usually works is they require you to go to a gun store, go to a licensed dealer in order to sell the gun to the private party. And one of the common criticisms of this policy is that it's basically unenforceable. There's, how would law enforcement know if you ever did that? Right. I mean, unless the gun later on shows up in some other crime.
Well, that's
maybe
the thing.
They can trace it back to this. But that's one of the main criticisms, that it's basically unenforceable.
Well, what I was gonna say is, I think the way that will always be a problem. So I think the only thing you can do to mitigate that issue is to build in an accountability measure, which is to say, like, you know, it's a back end thing, but if you don't do a background check and you sell a gun to someone through a private transfer, then they go and commit a crime with it, then you can be held responsible for it, which is obviously, it would be preferable to prevent that in the first place. But it's also like a, I mean, it's a deterrent. And as long as you make it clear that that's built into the law. That seems like the old, that seems like at least a potential way to address the issue that's reasonable.
Well, there's also obviously the concern that the other way of enforcing universal background check laws is through a registry of guns, which is how some of these states do enforce this. And and obviously that leads to a lot of concern over gun confiscation down the line, because if there's a registry, it makes it easier to confiscate the guns, as you're actually seeing right now in Canada, where they have recently banned the possession of AR-15s and similar rifles, and they have a registry of who owns those guns. So it'll, once that goes into effect in April, it'll be interesting to see, from certainly from down here in the States, how that plays out.
Oh my gosh, how do you like to be the guy who has to go seize the AR-15s from the gun owners who love them? And I actually, I'm dying to talk to you about AR-15s, because they, it's a gun that's been very maligned. It's used in a lot of these mass shootings. But is it really any different from a semi-automatic pistol that you'd see any place in, you know, in most women's handbags in Texas, right? We're going to pick it up there right after this break. And we've got a bit of breaking news to bring to you when we come back. Don't go away.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Stephen and Mike are back with me. But first, before we get back to them, let me bring you the breaking news. Justice Stephen Breyer of the U.S. Supreme Court has apparently decided to step down at the end of the current term. This first report was NBC News and Pete Williams, very long-term Supreme Court correspondent over there, and justice correspondent, and CNN going with it as well. Stephen Breyer to retire. He's 83 years old. He'll step down from the current court again at the end of the current term, which would mean June. And that means that Joe Biden will have a new Supreme Court justice on the court by its next term, which would begin October 1st of this year. That's huge and will come as big news and welcome news to the liberals out there who have been pressuring this guy to get the hell off the court while they still have a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate that could confirm him. And keep in mind, the Democrats do confirm the Senate. This won't be one of those things where Manchin or Sinema will stop a Democratic nominee from getting up onto the bench. I mean, unless it's somebody who really is totally unqualified, like we saw, for example, with Harriet Myers, who George W. Bush withdrew once he realized he couldn't get her through. And so this will mean that a liberal seat on the high court remains liberal. For all intents and purposes. I mean, if you want to read the tea leaves, that's what will happen. He'll step down. Biden will choose somebody else, nominate, and then they will have to be confirmed by the Senate. And that means the current balance of 6-3 on the Supreme Court this time next year will probably look exactly the same, except instead of having an 83-year-old man, he's the oldest man on the court right now, in that one seat, they'll probably have somebody in their 40s if the Democrats play this right, because you want to get somebody younger who can sit on the court for a long, long time. Big news. And who knows if Monica Crowley was right. Remember her theory? If she was right, who knows? It could be Kamala Harris. Biden has previously said that he said on the campaign trail, he can always change his mind, that if he were to have a seat open up, he would nominate a black female. She would qualify. Monica's theory was that they would turf Kamala Harris off to the Supreme Court. They would draft in somebody. She believes the Hillary Clinton team would make it would really want it to be them as VP. And that would pave the way toward better electoral returns for the Democrats in 2024. It's fascinating. My goodness. Okay, we'll continue to follow the news. Back to our gun debate. Stephen and Mike are back with me, and let's talk about the AR-15. AR-15 rifles, they look scary. They look like a machine gun. They're not a machine gun. They're nothing like a machine gun. They're actually much more like the Glock that you pull out of your, you know, side pocket and shoot. It's a semi-automatic rifle. That's my understanding. Stephen, you're the expert, but more and more there's a focus on these weapons in particular, trying to ban them. We talked earlier about how there's about 400 million plus weapons in the United States. I read that there are it's 434 million guns in the United States, according to the Trade Association for U.S. Firearm Industry. They estimate 20 million of those are ARs, some sort of AR weapon. So your thoughts on whether that gun is getting a bad rap.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot to talk about with the AR. I think, for one, it's the most popular rifle in the country, which is probably why it occasionally will turn up in some of these high-profile shootings, because, I mean, it's just so ubiquitous. There's one literally over my shoulder here for those watching on YouTube. But it is a derivative of the military rifle, you know, similar platform, but as you alluded to, a different firing mechanism inside of it that only allows for semi-automatic fire, which is one round per pull of the trigger, whereas the military version is capable of fully automatic fire, which is continuous fire when you pull the trigger until you let go. So that is one significant difference in the gun's operation, but otherwise it's you know, similar design, which is also probably one of the reasons why it's so popular, because you have a lot of veterans who come back and want to own the gun that they trained with, or at least the same platform. And it's the same reason that the 1911, the old Army sidearm, is extremely popular in America. You know, it was a gun designed for use in military context, and it's now probably, if not the most popular gun design in the handgun market, certainly one of the most popular. And you know, they are really not used that often in crime. Rifles as a whole, which ARs are just a subset of, are only used in about 300 murders per year, according to the FBI. That's out of about 15,000 per year, and over the last 2 years that number has actually increased quite a bit, as you alluded to earlier in the show. And so, you know, they get a lot of attention probably because of how they look. They look similar to the military gun. They are a similar design. But when you look at the data, they're clearly not drivers of the crime epidemic in America. And I don't think they were drivers of the murder spike we've seen over the last 2 years either. These aren't guns that are commonly used by criminals in their activity. So I think is an important distinction to make.
Mike, we saw them used, an AR-15 was used in the Parkland shooting in Florida, and the school shooting there, where I think it was 17 kids were killed. 17. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then there are AR-15 style rifles, because AR-15, I guess, is a brand name. So you have guns that look just like that. One was used in Aurora, Colorado, that movie theater mass shooting.
Sandy Hook as well. Yeah.
Sandy Hook, the worst. I mean, honestly, just the most unfathomable mass shooting of all time. So that this leads people, I think, in great frustration, including myself, saying, what the hell can we do? What can we do? Do everything. That leads people to say, get rid of the AR-15s. But I just don't, that's not realistically the answer. It's the same thing as a handgun, which is what was used, for example, in Virginia Tech, the most deadly mass shooting we've had of all time. I mean, or at least in recent history, at a school, I mean. So you tell me whether the AR-15 is being sort of wrongly targeted or singled out.
Well, I think, first of all, everything Stephen said is right. And so it's worth looking at statistics and numbers, and the point you're making is also correct too. I mean, ultimately, it's a small figure in a much vaster scale of gun homicide. I mean, it just the problem, I guess, is it has an outside presence because of where it has shown up historically, which are these like milestone mass shooting events that are really, if you think about it, they're fairly akin to acts of terrorism in the sense that, like, it's, while they're ultimately still not frequent, they're persistent enough that they upset the social contract, especially in places that we expect to be safe, whether that be our children's schools or the, you know, church, a concert, the movie theater, any of the places that you're talking about. So it obviously it becomes like a symbol, and that, I guess, is why people are so drawn to it, because it creates an obviously visceral reaction, especially because think about the things that are tied to it, or the deaths of children. That's, I think, the first thing people come to mind. I think the AR first became widely recognized after Sandy Hook as like a tool of terror. But if you were actually seeking, and I think that everybody is, most people, we are anyway, to address like everyday gun violence, then of course, like, banning the AR is really not going to make a dent in that. And that's not going to be the thing that's going to change the lives of people who actually live with this on a daily basis. Which is, again, why I could come back to just, it's why it feels like accountability is the most important thing. I mean, you're talking about the Michigan shooting and the fact that in the school there, that the parents are being prosecuted for that. That's an incredibly, as you know, an incredibly rare outcome. People who traditionally don't secure their firearms in such a way in which their children can't get a hold of them are not, even when states have laws that seek to hold people accountable for failing to secure their firearms in such a way that minors can't get them, those cases are rarely prosecuted in the first place.
Let's pause there, because that kid, he's 15 years old. His parents wanted him to have it. Like that case is an outlier in that they got him the gun. They knew he was having trouble. The school certainly had identified him as a disturbed kid, and the parents were celebratory of him having the gun. I mean, even if you had a law that said you must secure the gun from the child, do any of us believe these parents would have said, make sure you lock it up so that he can't get it? They were thrilled that he had it.
No, I presumably they bought him a gun to use, which is I think the less typical scenario than a parent owning a gun that is not the child's and just leaving it unsecured so that somebody can like go easily retrieve it. So it's, I mean, in some ways the scenario is unique because in theory it was his. Whereas like a more typical scenario would be like Newtown, right, where the kid gets his mom's gun and then wreaks havoc with it. So yeah,
but that's also in that situation, though, and knowing what we now know about that sick, sick killer at Newtown, nothing would have stopped him. Now, you think if the mother put a lock on the gun cabinet, that he wouldn't have broken it and got, like, it's absurd. These mass killers will kill. They will find a way. This is what drives me nuts about the gun debate. Look, and I said this, I was on the air at NBC after Florida and Parkland, and I said, everything has to be on the table. You know, this has to stop happening. Everything needs to be on the table. There can be no NRA shutdowns of the discussion. There can be no, nothing's on the table, like something's off limits. But the thing I always come back to is, show me the thing that would have stopped it. And for me, and I'm happy if you want to talk me out of this, for me, I always come back to, we need better interventions when we see somebody's mental health going south. It's, talk about red flags. Red flags are almost always all over these mass shooters. Almost always. It's very rare that you can look back and say there was nothing we should have seen. What we need is a meaningful place to put them and make it easier to commit them while that aura of concern, suspicion is around them. Go ahead.
I think that's true. I don't think taking stricter measures when it comes to like, you know, gun storage and having a robust public education campaign in support of those laws to like let people know that they exist would be at the exclusion of also having like a far better system for dealing with people who are like struggling with their mental health. I mean, I think that those things probably in fact should and ought to go hand in hand with each other. So that's true. Can I say for sure that, like, if there was a, you know, if there was a law in the books that said, like, if you have a gun, you're required to secure it in such a way so your minor can't get it. And if they do, you're going to be held liable and prosecuted in some way with, you know, whatever the penalty is. If that was widely understood to be the law, would it eliminate, like, these situations? No, not any more than having, like, the legal limit on alcohol consumption, like, for when you're going to drive a car, has eliminated drunk driving. Usually the function of a law most of the time is to be a deterrent, is it not? I mean, that's sort of the, it doesn't fix everything.
You're looking to diminish, not to entirely eliminate. I mean, you'd like to eliminate, but I see your point. Yeah. Well, what about,
sure. Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I just have two points to make here real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Stephen.
Because, you know, that's fair, right? Obviously, certainly sometimes you could get arguments that if it doesn't completely eliminate the problem, you know, it's completely useless altogether. And I, you know, Mike's point there is fair, that about diminishing and how law works in real life, that you're not going to, by making murder illegal, you don't eliminate murder, but doesn't mean it should be legal. I understand that. Two points though. One, a lot of these mass shooters, if you look through the history here, have been able to obtain guns legally, including the Parkland shooter, because a lot of the red flags that they exhibited along the way went unnoticed or undealt with. The Parkland shooter is a very good example of this, because he had actually been involved. One, he had had suicidal ideation that he expressed to school officials. He could have been committed for that. He was involved in several domestic violence incidents, which he could have been charged over. Either one of those things would have at least made him a prohibited person. And it would have made it much more difficult for him to obtain a gun in that circumstance. And there's a number of shooters, including the Virginia Tech shooter, was prohibited, but his records weren't in the system. Same thing for the Texas church shooter. There's a lot of these examples of either situations where the person ought to have been prohibited if somebody had taken action, or they were prohibited, but the system didn't work for various reasons. And so there should be more done about that. Red flag laws have been one solution to this, but of course they have their own issues. Because, you know, the NRA and other gun rights activists are amenable to this concept in theory, but in practice, they've been opposed to most of the actual laws that have been passed because they don't deal with a number of problems. One, they don't have the due process protections that a lot of people would find necessary for something like seizing a gun from someone, even temporarily, because owning a gun is a constitutionally protected right in America. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very serious thing to take that right away from somebody, especially with things like ex parte hearings or without, legal representation for the person being accused. And then on the other point, you know, assault weapons bans have been sort of the common response to most mass shootings, including Parkland or Sandy Hook or any number of these attacks that have, as you guys mentioned, featured AR-15s being used. But the way that they work in practice, it's very questionable as to how much of an effect they would have.
What's included in an assault weapons ban? I mean, and a semi-automatic weapon? And like, how are we going to get all those? 70
right.
million.
Well, so usually the way that they are written is that they go after effectively cosmetic features. And this is the common critique of them, that you can't have a pistol grip with a flash hider on a semi-automatic rifle that also accepts detachable magazines. And so, you know, you can have a gun that has all the same functionality as an AR-15, but remains legal under an assault weapons ban because it doesn't have the sort of cosmetic features that an AR-15 has. Or you can actually, and this commonly happens, you can modify an AR-15 to just remove the cosmetic features that are actually banned under these proposals. And, you know, in the end, they're kind of designed oftentimes to make it slightly more inconvenient for somebody who's trying to perpetrate a mass shooting to carry one out, rather than dealing with, you know, perhaps the red flags of a potential perpetrator instead. Like the you know, magazine capacity limits, the one of the main arguments for why those might be effective against mass shootings is that the shooter would have to reload their gun more often, in theory, mm-hmm. if you were able to eliminate the hundreds of millions of high capacity magazines that are now in circulation in the United States. And so this sort of, I think there's a lot of almost magical thinking that goes into some of these restrictions that happen to be, unfortunately, the main policy prescriptions that we've been debating for 30 years.
Yes.
There's a lot of other things that we could look at in terms of how to prevent these things. I mean, red flag laws are more recent innovation that has unfortunately become extremely polarized. They only really pass in blue states at this point because of the opposition I mentioned earlier, that there isn't really, doesn't seem to be a lot of actual interest among our political leaders to come together and try to work out a red flag law that deals with some of the critiques that people have of them. And
yeah, like how can we ensure due process and make sure it's not being used punitively, let's say by an ex-wife on an ex-husband who doesn't deserve to have his gun taken away. Just to correct something I said, it's not 70 million semi-automatic weapons in America. It's 70% of the gun market is semi-automatic weapons. And again, the gun market has put 434 million guns into America. So, I mean, you're talking hundreds of millions of semi-automatic pistols out there. There's no way of seizing them. That's not happening. That's just not.
Yeah.
And so we pacify ourselves by saying, well, automatic weapons ban or assault weapons ban. So we'll get like the worst of the worst. Okay, you're still going to have hundreds of millions of guns in America. And don't forget, as I said, the shooter at Virginia Tech had two semi-automatic pistols. That's what he did. You can unleash a lot of hell with just a semi-automatic weapon, handgun, a pistol. Yeah, and those are never going to go away. Defense, They're not going to go away. So what's the answer, right? So let's talk to the guys right after this quick break about, is there something that we actually could do to make our communities safer against bad guys who get their hands on guns? Don't go away. Remember, you can find The Megyn Kelly Show live on SiriusXM Triumph Channel 111 every weekday at noon East, and the full video show and clips by subscribing to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/MegynKelly. Would love it if you went there now and checked out our opening monologue from yesterday, which was about a response to Whoopi Goldberg trying to call people who want the COVID restrictions to go away selfish, saying, how dare we? Right? So I had some words for her that I think you'll enjoy. If you prefer an audio podcast, you can subscribe and download on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast for free. And there you will find our full archives with more than 240 shows, including our other debates and discussions on climate change, on Israel and Gaza, on trans athletes, and more. Don't go away.
Hollywood is under siege, covertly compromised by a global adversary. The same Hollywood that sold the American dream to the world is now making nightmares a reality. The American way of life is being censored by the Chinese Communist Party. Some films have scenes completely altered. Other films have lost their funding or been canceled altogether. Some actors have been banned from China for supporting human rights. Hollywood Takeover is a documentary brought to you by the Epoch Times, revealing how the CCP has infiltrated major movie studios. Join Chris Fenton, a former Hollywood executive, and Tiffany Meyer, an investigative news reporter, through their journey in exposing how the film industry gradually lost its integrity on its path to profits. Don't miss the most important documentary ever made about Hollywood. For a limited time, watch the first 10 minutes for free on HollywoodTakeover.com/MK. That's HollywoodTakeover.com/MK.
There are suggestions that communities with stricter gun laws may not be any safer than those that don't have strict gun laws. But is that true? One of the many things we're going to get to today on our debate between Stephen Gutowski, founder of The Reload, and Mike Spees, a senior writer for The Trace. Okay, so we'll get to that in 1 second. But I'm just looking at the list of things that Joe Biden had been pushing on the campaign trail. We've talked about two of them: assault weapons ban, universal background checks. The others that he has been pushing are an end to internet firearm purchases. And then there's just sort of a slew of executive actions, which he's actually taken in part and is under pressure to take, which we'll get to. But you tell me, I'll start with you as somebody who is reasonable and pro-gun. Stephen, is there anything that you think we can be doing? You heard Mike say more accountability for, you know, gun owners. But is there anything you think we can be doing to try to prevent? I mean, we can't always stop criminals from, you know, behaving criminally. But is there any way of cutting down on the number of mass shootings or on just how mass they are?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, one thing I would note, just going off what you'd said before the break, is that there, as you mentioned earlier, there's 20 million AR-15s and similar style rifles in the country. And I just want to put that in context of that people can understand. Because I think when you get to these big numbers, it's easy to just think, oh, that's a lot. Well, the Small Arms Survey, which is a nonprofit that estimates these things, estimates there's about 1 million small arms in possession of police in the United States, in the entire law enforcement community in the United States, and about 4 million in the United States military. So that gives you some
idea. You mean like their personal use?
No, just
On the job?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
The entire country's law enforcement has about 1 million small arms. So U.S. civilians own about 20 times that number in just AR-15 and similar rifles alone. Wow. So it gives you a better idea of like how impractical it is to actually try and collect all of those firearms as a solution to these issues. You know, so, you know, because that is something that, you know, you've had people like Beto O'Rourke suggest, you know, it's obviously not every gun control activist wants this, but it's something that people do legitimately want to try. But as far as solutions go.
Well, stand by, because I'll let Mike respond to that point and then we'll go back to solutions. Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say, you just highlighted a very interesting point. I mean, which is to say that you've just pointed out that law enforcement is vastly outgunned when it compared to the American public. And we're talking many orders of magnitude. And I guess, I mean, that sort of, I guess, throws things in sharp relief for me. I mean, that one of the things that makes police encounters, one of the factors more fraught, right, is that police have to assume that any situation they're walking into, somebody could have a gun. And so then it raises the question of what do you do about the guns that are already out there, right? That's sort of the point you're making. Like you can regulate what's not on the market yet, but there are already, as Megan, I think you said, about 400 and something million firearms that are already in the hands of Americans.
434.
And that does 434. And those are legal guns, right? That doesn't include whatever's on the, what is the unknown firearms. So, you know, it is sort of a problem for sure that, you know, law enforcement doesn't know where those guns are and that they can't actually be accounted for. I realize that like making the argument for a registry, and I'm not about to do that, is effectively a political non-starter, though it tends to be the case that arguments for any kind of regulation, including red flag laws, as you're pointing out, often are non-starters. So, you know, what does it even matter? So why not just say whatever I want? And in that case, I think it's a fairly weak argument, which is it's sort of how this is made, the sort of abstract, slippery slope argument that if Americans were somehow required to register their guns, it would open the door to a certain kind of tyranny in which, you know, there would be mass gun confiscation. I know you're pointing out what's happening in Canada with AR-15s. All the points that have been made here about AR-15s are valid and right. There is, I think, a question that is asked, which is like why, what civilian application do these weapons have? You could say the same thing about handguns too. But I think that's sort of the point that gets raised because they show up because their analog is the military rifle that you were talking about.
And I get it. You're explaining why they continue to be targeted without defending necessarily the targeting, because if AR-15s, if we could get rid of those and get rid of mass shootings, I mean, every mom I know would be in line to do that, to vote for the guy who would do that. But it's, we all know the truth. It's not going to, you know, as I said, somebody will do the math on 70% of 434 million and tell me how many semi-automatic pistols there are. Okay, so one more quick break because we do have to pay bills, and then get to the solutions and about what Joe Biden's pushing now, and also whether more and more states should pursue the equivalent of the Texas abortion ban approach on guns, because now at least three states are. Will it succeed? Don't go away.
Hollywood is under siege, covertly compromised by a global adversary. The same Hollywood that sold the American dream to the world is now making nightmares a reality. The American way of life is being censored by the Chinese Communist Party. Some films have scenes completely altered. Other films have lost their funding or been canceled altogether. Some actors have been banned from China for supporting human rights. Hollywood Takeover is a documentary brought to you by the Epoch Times, revealing how the CCP has infiltrated major movie studios. Join Chris Fenton, a former Hollywood executive, and Tiffany Meyer, an investigative news reporter, through their journey in exposing how the film industry gradually lost its integrity on its path to profits. Don't miss the most important documentary ever made about Hollywood. For a limited time, watch the first 10 minutes for free on HollywoodTakeover.com/MK. That's HollywoodTakeover.com/MK.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
We're about to get into solutions, and one of the ones proposed by Joe Biden is smart guns. Smart guns. He has said that he would like to see eventually 100% of all the new guns sold in America be, quote, smart guns. Stephen, what is a smart gun, and is that a smart idea?
Well, he's actually said something more extreme than that, especially during the debates, that he wanted all guns immediately to only be sold as smart guns, which right now is not possible because there isn't a single one on the market. However, there are some coming to market this year, and I actually was able to see one in person at the industry's trade show in Las Vegas last week. But a smart gun is the way that we talk about it generally in media is a gun that has an internal locking mechanism built into the actual firearm that uses either a fingerprint scanner or an RFID reader paired with like a special watch or a special ring in order to unlock the gun so that the user can shoot it. Whether they're a good idea or not is sort of up for debate about just whether, you know, somebody would be interested in buying something like that. The more serious debate is over whether or not they should be mandated as what the president wants to do.
Well, what would be the reason not to do it, right? So to make it, I mean, I guess the goal is that way your kid can't fire your gun if they find it loaded in your bedstand, right. Or some thief who comes into your house and steals your gun isn't going to be able to make it operate unless they steal your ring, which you presumably have on you, and so on. So they're trying to cut down on illegal thefts and other thefts of guns and to make them not usable.
That's the idea, right? But as anyone who's ever used a cell phone with a fingerprint scanner could probably tell you, they are not the most reliable things, and you might not want to bet your life on whether or not your fingerprint scanner can actually read your fingerprint at the moment you need to shoot the gun. Mm-hmm. So you can see the sort of the obvious drawbacks of this sort of technology. It sounds great in practice or great in theory, and it could work in practice. And all these guns that are coming to market are still early prototypes, frankly. I wasn't even able to actually manipulate the gun or handle it at SHOT Show. So we don't really know how well they work at this point. And it's still in its infancy, largely because there was a mandate in New Jersey that said they had passed a law in 2002 so that said as soon as one of these sorts of guns becomes available on the market anywhere in the country, that would be the only kind of gun that could be sold in New Jersey. you know, eliminating completely traditional firearms, which a lot of people are highly skeptical of the reliability of these kinds of guns. I mean, just think about, you know, the gun you use for self-defense needing to be recharged in and of itself, even if the technology works perfectly, is a problem that a lot of people are going to have.
Good point. The other thing is, Mike, that there was a Reuters article pointing out that in 2014, a German company put a smart gun, 22 caliber pistol on the market, but it was pulled after hackers discovered a way to remotely jam the gun's radio signals, and using magnets, they found a way to fire the gun when it should have been locked. So that seems like it should be the end of the smart gun discussion, but am I wrong?
No, I mean, I look, in terms of just looking at the reliability of technology, it's definitely not unfair to raise the questions that Stephen is raising. It's true. I mean, I struggle with the thumbprint thing on my phone all the time. I guess, though, you sort of bring up a different point, which is like, that's a problem because of a self-defense scenario. But the one thing that we don't really address is that the vast majority of people who have guns for self-defense scenarios are never going to be in a scenario in which they need them for self-defense. I mean, there's not like an exact number on this, but it's just like traditionally the case that when it comes to legal gun ownerships, specifically in outstates, rural areas, suburbs, that sort of drive policy in a lot of places, those are places that have like generally like fairly low rates of gun violence. And again, I'm not saying, well, then that means that, you know, that's the point. I'm not trying to make the point. That should mean, well, then, you know, for that reason, you should have to have a smart gun because you're probably never going to have to use it. But it is also worth stating that a lot of supply is driven by this theoretical idea that you're going to need a gun in a situation that you're almost never going to be in. But that supply also then fuels the illegal gun market, creating problems for those that are actually going to be in that situation.
What about this? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, as far as how often guns are needed in self-defense. I mean, obviously there's quite a lot of controversy over this, and there's several different estimates you could look at. Gary Kleck, who's a criminologist at Florida State University, is well known for studying this topic, and has come up, you know, he's done surveys that indicate there's 2 to 3 million self-defense uses of guns each year. Others have put the number, you know, significantly lower than that, although there was a DOJ review during the Obama administration that concluded that, you know, whatever estimate you use for how often guns are used in self-defense, it's still clear that they're used far more often for self-defense than they are to commit crimes by any estimate that's out there. So, you know, just to speak to that a little bit, I understand what Mike's getting at as far as like, hopefully most people will never have to use the guns that they have bought for self-defense, because nobody wants to be in a situation where you have to use deadly force against someone else. But people do buy them because they want to have that option, just like you would buy a fire extinguisher, even though you hope never to have to use it. And that's where smart guns also come into play. It's like, people should be able to buy them if they want them. You know, people buy biometric safes that have some of the similar drawbacks, right, to put a gun into. So, you know, I could see somebody wanting to integrate those two things.
What about, but, you know, my history tells me that the real purpose behind the Second Amendment was people wanted to be armed in case the government came knocking, and in case a militia organized by the government came to sort of take over their house, their belongings, and so on. And I'm not saying that's going to happen in 2022. Yeah, I'm not saying that's going to happen.
That's literally what happened at Concord and Lexington, right? That was the spark of the American Revolution. Was the shot heard around the world was fired in opposition to the British Army trying to confiscate guns from the colonists. So yeah, that's a big part of American gun tradition.
That seems to me an argument against the smart gun, because it's like, why would you give control to, like, who's to say the government wouldn't be able to interfere with all of that technology to shut down the use of your gun, of everyone's gun, you know, in some crazy, you know, conspiracy theory world. But I mean, if you look at sort of the purpose behind the Second Amendment, what people were worried about, and there are some people who are worried about our government or whatever, they have a right, it's written right into their constitution. I don't think they want to give anybody, hackers or far more nefarious actors, the ability to stop their gun from firing, right, from a remote place, and that would be the concern.
I don't, if for what it's, and you know, I'm not one to really say which is the best or most useful policy, and if I, but if, I mean, my personal assessment is I do think smart guns probably rank pretty low on that list. I think there are more useful things or smarter things that could potentially be done. I am curious, though, if I don't mind backing up for 1 second. Stephen, did you say there are numbers that suggest that self-defense shootings outnumber criminal shooting?
Yes.
That seems, I've never seen it before. I one thing that is surprising, there are a couple of things that are surprising to me about that. Well, in fact, just the idea of it, that that seems very shocking to me. But two, there's also this other question of how self-defense shootings get characterized as self-defense shooting, which is to say, I mean, it's a subjective scenario that, I mean, is retroactively characterized as self-defense by the person who pulled the trigger. What is the number? I mean, what do you have numbers?
Yeah, this is from a DOJ review that was ordered under the Obama administration, and I believe it was 2014, where they reviewed some of the studies that have looked at how frequent defensive gun uses are. And to be clear, defensive gun use does not necessarily mean that somebody actually shot their gun at someone else. It can be a scenario where
brandishing,
display the gun to deter someone from attacking them, similar situation. And those are, Gary Kleck's numbers are self-reported. It's a survey. So some of those uses may even be, you know, illegal in theory, although, you know, Gary Kleck's written a lot about this. I'd encourage people to, you know, go and read his actual writing to get a better view of it and some of the critiques of it as well, as you've mentioned here. But yeah, effectively, you know, DOJ compared that and some other estimates that put the numbers lower. There's a couple of crime surveys that are done each year by different institutions that somewhat address defensive gun uses that put the number lower, maybe 500,000 instead of 2 million to 3 million a year. And then, you know, they looked at the number of crimes committed with a firearm as well, which tend to be in the 100,000 range, not necessarily murders. Like we talked about murders earlier, that's obviously a smaller number, but, you know, so you get, when the DOJ looked at those two comparisons, they found that whatever the estimates were, you know, and there is a range, defensive gun use was still more common than criminal gun use in the United States. And so that was just the point I was getting at as far as, you know, what the information is available out there on how guns are used. Certainly, even with 3 million defensive gun uses a year, that's still, you know, less than 1% of all guns being used in self-defense. You know, as we mentioned earlier, because there's over 400 million in the country. So, you know,
point. Go ahead, Mike.
I think like this one thing is interesting, you know, just to at least talk about is that the idea of self-defense as a right, I don't mean with a gun specifically, just in general, you know, it's sort of inarguable. One should have the right to defend themselves, but it's interesting how self-defense is also, I mean, it's also a marketing concept. And the problem with that, going back to what I was saying earlier, is that that marketing tends to be directed at communities that are, again, have generally fairly low rates of gun violence. And I think it would be pretty hard to challenge the idea that most gun owners will never encounter that kind of situation where they'll have to pull their gun.
Yeah.
But because that, I mean, again, it's because that's a driver of supply. And because we have this issue in which, as I was saying earlier, gun sellers are not really required to secure their firearms in such a way that it's ultimately they're fairly easy targets for theft. And also, this is an ATF problem. The ATF does a pretty bad job at shutting down gun dealers that engage in trafficking activity. You know, inspections are not conducted as frequently as they should be. As you know, you're not allowed to You're not allowed to inspect a store more than one time a year if that store gets inspected at all. Stores that engage in bad activity, whether it be like poor accounting of inventory, other red flag issues, often they're let off with a warning multiple times when it becomes fairly clear that they're engaged in trafficking. And obviously those weapons wind up in the communities where guns are used in a way that sort of terrorizes people on a daily basis. And I think, so anyway, this is all a way to say, if I were to pick, and I think this is where I'll say something that probably everybody will disagree with, but if I was thinking about it, a useful tactic for accountability, then I think that it would make more sense to focus on the sort of broad industry immunity that exists right now for the gun industry.
Okay, so now let's get to it, because you've been pushing accountability and we haven't really gotten into what does that mean, right? Because the gun manufacturers are not allowed, they may not be held liable right now for the use of their firearm in a homicide, right? We haven't done to them what we did to cigarette companies. And though, I mean, I don't think it's exactly the same thing, right? the gun manufacturers versus cigarette manufacturers. But in any event, they are shielded from liability. And do you think that shield should be removed?
I think, well, I mean, I guess, maybe at least amended. I mean, I think it's a problem that it's so, I mean, I know there are some lawsuits that are proceeding right now and have gotten much farther than I think anyone imagined they would. I think the law is frequently misunderstood, as I think Stephen has smartly pointed out before publicly. The law does not allow, gun makers to market products in like an overly sexy way that makes people want them. That's not covered by industry immunity. But there is this question about whether or not if your product, and again, opioids are certainly not a perfect analog either, but if your product is being somewhat chronically misused and leading to like a fair amount of death every single year. The question of like what, for instance, like what, you know, what, there are certain things I don't know the best way, but it seems like a problem that there's no way to hold somebody accountable for that, or a company accountable for that just sort of off the table. You know, there's no avenue toward discovery, no way to know, for example, to what extent, like, you know, companies are aware or what is it built into their model, to what extent like their firearms are going to end up being trafficked every year and wind up on, you know, on the black market as opposed to the legal market. And is there, you know, what information are they internally keeping on distributors? And how we're talking about bad apple gun dealers.
But I mean, think about this. A gun manufacturer could be held liable if a person gets killed because the gun malfunctioned and the person got killed.
Right. Yes.
Because the gun wasn't made properly. In the same way as if my brakes in my car don't work and I, God forbid, get hurt, I can sue the car manufacturer. But firearm injury is apparently the 13th leading cause of death in this country, and that eclipses car crashes for the fourth year in a row, according to my data here. It's more likely to kill you than a car crash is, and yet 5 years ago it wasn't that way. You're more likely to die in a car crash, and yet we don't hold the car industry responsible for drivers who take out the cars and don't drive them well and die or kill somebody. In the same way, we don't require the gun manufacturers to foresee improper use of their product in a way that, you know, if you look at 434 million guns in America and consider the fact that we've had 45,000 people killed by guns a year, and 60% of those are suicides, you can't hold somebody liable for a suicide. It's like you're getting down to numbers that are on a percentage basis that are pretty small.
Well, that's true. I mean, I guess the problem with comparing it to the car industry is there's a distinction between car accidents versus like a deliberate misuse, as you know what I mean? I mean, there are obviously some people use their car to kill people on purpose. Mm-hmm. But most of the time when people are dying in car accidents, it is because it is an accident. And I, again, I don't want to suggest that this is sort of a perfect way to put a dent in a problem that I want to say, we could say it plagues the country. Really, it plagues areas of the country. But I guess it's more like the idea that it's completely off the table, rather than considering each case on its merits is sort of the problem from my perspective.
Well, I would question this just a little bit here, because I think if there was proof that gun companies were intentionally selling guns to people that they knew were going to commit crimes with them, that they probably could be held liable, even with the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case. Obviously, there's the argument that you'd need to get to discovery in some of these lawsuits in order to find the evidence of this. And fair enough, I suppose. But more often, what you're seeing with this controversy, and this goes back to the 90s as well, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was a response to a tactic used by gun control groups in the 90s to enlist local cities to sue gun manufacturers over the criminal use of their products by third parties, generally years later. Most guns that are recovered at crime scenes, according to the ATF's trace data, aren't recovered until 8 to 10 years after they've been sold for the first time, after the gun dealer sold it to a distributor who sold it to the gun maker sold it to a distributor who sold it to a retail customer. So it's kind of hard to make that direct liability connection.
Yeah, it's not like Smith and Wesson directly to the man who ran out and committed a mass murder. It's not that simple to trace the and that matters. That proximate cause matters when it comes to civil liability.
And this was a specific problem with this industry. You weren't seeing these sorts of lawsuits against Ford for people who, like you alluded to earlier, go out and kill people with their cars by running them over intentionally. That you don't see that sort of tactic used against them. And that's why the gun industry has this particular law in place.
While we're on the subject of liability, right, putting some skin in the game for the gun manufacturers, there are now three states, California, New York, and one other, that are styling laws, they're drafting laws that look like the Texas anti-abortion law that was just challenged at the U.S. Supreme Court, where they understand if they were to say no guns in California, it would be reversed immediately. But instead, because of the Second Amendment, they're writing laws like if you understand that somebody's committed gun violence or is manufacturing guns, there can be a private civil suit against them because we're declaring that you have a private right to sue in such cases. And that is working right now in Texas. And there's a question about whether it could work against guns. It was a concern expressed by Justice Kavanaugh from the bench when they heard the Texas abortion case. It's been a concern expressed by gun advocates who say this is a slippery slope.
Hollywood is under siege, covertly compromised by a global adversary. The same Hollywood that sold the American dream to the world is now making nightmares a reality. The American way of life is being censored by the Chinese Communist Party. Some films have scenes completely altered. Other films have lost their funding or been canceled altogether. Some actors have been banned from China for supporting human rights. Hollywood Takeover is a documentary brought to you by the Epoch Times, revealing how the CCP has infiltrated major movie studios. Join Chris Fenton, a former Hollywood executive, and Tiffany Meyer, an investigative news reporter, through their journey in exposing how the film industry gradually lost its integrity on its path to profits. Don't miss the most important documentary ever made about Hollywood. For a limited time, watch the first 10 minutes for free on HollywoodTakeover.com/MK. That's HollywoodTakeover.com/MK.
By the way, my crack producers sent me the article that I think you were referencing, Stephen. This is from Forbes, and it's talking about, this is Forbes article from 2018. 18. It's talking about a 2013 study ordered by the Centers for Disease Control. And they are saying that essentially, if you take a look at the data released by the CDC, their data imply that defensive uses of guns by crime victims are far more common than offensive uses by criminals. And it goes on from there. But in any event, okay, so liability. The three states right now, California, Illinois, and New York, are considering proposals that would mirror in approach the Texas abortion law crackdown, where they create a civil liability, a right to sue civilly against people who, in New York, for example, violate New York's gun laws. So gun laws that might not be upheld, anti-gun laws that might not be upheld if the state just wrote them and tried to start enforcing them, may now be written in as broad and offensive to the Second Amendment way as possible, and could potentially stand if they just make it not the state who's going to enforce this, but it's just creating a private cause of action by private citizens who see gun owners having a gun or having concealed carry in a way that doesn't comport with a law that they would like to write. So you tell me, Stephen, whether this is troubling to you and whether you think it'll work.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think the trend overall is troubling. It feels like perhaps if things keep going in this direction, we're all going to be incentivized to sue each other over everything.
Well, we already are. That's
future,
America.
Right? fair point. But I think it was clear once Texas went down this road with this sort of novel approach to trying to institute an abortion ban, whatever you think of the underlying issue. Obviously people can agree or disagree with abortion and whether it should be legal, just like with guns. But it was clear that this would be used probably immediately on trying to enforce gun control laws that couldn't otherwise withstand judicial scrutiny. And now you're seeing sort of the first grasps at this with California's governor Newsom and the attorney general in New York, Letitia James. And, I don't think that their proposals make a lot of sense, because right now what they've said is just, we're going to do the same things we're already doing with past laws. Like California already has an assault weapons ban and bans on homemade firearms that aren't serialized. And so,
wait, can I ask you that? Because I was confused too. Tish James, the AG of New York, that's what she said. She said, I'm writing a proposal that would allow residents to sue for violations of New York's weapons ban. It's like, well, wait a minute.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah, it doesn't fit.
The ban that's already on the books, right, has been upheld by the courts as constitutional. Right. So why do you need to create, like, you're not doing what Texas did. Texas intentionally wrote a law that it knew would be unconstitutional if enforced by the state. And they just transferred sort of the right of enforcement to private citizens in civil lawsuits. And that's how they tried to do the end around. Like, unless that's what these states are doing, they're not doing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that the idea has been planted, and now you could use this to outlaw gun ownership or gun dealing altogether. Yeah, if you wanted to. And frankly, the Supreme Court, it hasn't completely validated this approach, but by letting this law hang around in this way, my guess is that the courts will figure this out eventually. It is a hard tactic to come to grips with, is my understanding. I'm not a legal expert, but from what I've heard and what I've read, it is a hard tactic to deal with based on the way it works. But I'm sure, my guess is they'll figure it out at some point.
I mean, I'm not privy to the thinking of any of the attorneys general or governors in any of those states. But it also, there's at least part of me that thinks that approach is also just a way to highlight the problems with the Texas law. I mean, I don't know that would mm-hmm. like, I don't, you know, it was sort of, it was, yeah. it was clearly a,
it's not
as
real.
Much of a, I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily, a thought that this is going to have this is going to be a really useful approach to, to bringing down gun violence so much as just like, if you're going to do this, and infringe on the rights of so many people in Texas and turn people against each other and into basically informants and upset the social contract. Well, then we can do the same thing too, as you're pointing out, to like another sacred right that you care about. And it just, it seems like it's
on and
just
on
as plausible, but it's a way.
Okay.
Let me
ask you a question. We haven't touched on straw purchases, and I feel like we should, because this is another big thing you hear from, people who want gun reform, that we have to crack down on straw purchases. So let me give you that one, Mike. What is a straw purchase? And is there any way of cracking down on it?
I mean, it's when you're not able to purchase a firearm, so you have somebody else purchase one for you who is able to legally buy one.
And is that often done by gun salesmen with a wink and a nod, like they know it's not the person, but you know, here you go anyway because I want the money.
Well, I don't. You know, it would be intellectually dishonest in me to suggest that that happens often, only because I don't know if there's a way of empirically measuring that. Certainly there are plenty. I mean, there are certainly gun dealers who know and are. You know, engage in those kinds of trafficking schemes and are aware that they're selling to people, like, you know, essentially to launder firearms to people who aren't supposed to have them. I mean, I think
if the gun seller doesn't know, then how do we crack down on it? Because it's already illegal for somebody to do that.
So one way to potentially crack down on it, just potentially, and is, again, another accountability measure, which is like in most places, I think almost every place. This has been a big fight in Philadelphia, which is where, you know, Stephen's backyard or old backyard, which is putting a requirement. It would not be a stolen weapon. But, most places, you're not required to report to the police if your firearm has gone missing. If you had a measure in place that required you to do that and you were a straw purchaser and then the gun you bought wound up in the hands of somebody else who committed a crime with it, that could be one potential way. I mean, it's a back end. It's not a front end. I don't know that you can stop it on the front end, but if a straw purchaser shows up in like a trace, I mean, that's sort of the, you know, that I can't really think of another way. I mean, that's sort of the only...
What I would suggest, one, that this is an area where you probably have broad agreement, prosecution of straw purchasers, people who are intentionally lying to buy a gun for someone they know can't legally own one. I think a lot of people across the spectrum on this particular point would agree that we want to see further enforcement of this, because you don't often see crimes like that, or even a crime where somebody who is prohibited tries to buy a gun and fails the background check. Often these don't rank at the top of federal prosecutors' priority lists. So they don't tend to get there. They tend to be paperwork crimes, right? And so they're not very sexy to prosecute, but they are fairly important. I think most people would agree. And this sort of goes back to your original question of like, how do we deal with gun crime? Perhaps, you know, mass shootings and your general everyday sort of gun crime are different problems that have different solutions. But one thing that I think a lot of pro-gun advocates would say is stricter enforcement of current gun laws, like straw purchasing infractions, would be one way of reducing crime going forward. And so this straw purchases, you know, if you are more often prosecuting people for committing them, especially in circumstances where it's clear that they knew they were selling a gun or buying a gun for a criminal, that's something that you could probably see quite a lot of agreement on.
Okay. Let me ask you the question of gun laws. If we tighten them up, New York City's got very tight gun laws. Most of the blue states have tighter gun laws than the red states. And yet we do see, you know, tons of murders and homicides in states like New York, in New York City, in Chicago, which is in Illinois, and in California, which has, you know, tight gun laws as well. And whenever that happens, whenever you see like a record number of homicides in Chicago, which we saw in 2021, people say, oh, so much for the gun laws, right? Like the tighter gun laws don't lead to a lower crime rate. So I don't know whether that's true. We did look up a chart, and this is from the Giffords Center, as in Gabby Giffords, and they are definitely not pro-gun. You know, they want gun reform and they want it yesterday. And I understand that, especially given what happened to her. But they went through and sort of ranked each state, all 50 states, by the strength of their gun laws. And so if you have a really, really tight restrictions like California does, like they're ranked number one in terms of the number of gun laws they have and how strong they are. And then they said how many deaths per 100,000 by guns. And California has only 7 deaths per 100,000. And then you've got, if you look up and down the list, the states that have like an F from the Gifford Center and rank at the bottom of the list in terms of gun law and gun control, they do have higher gun deaths per 100,000. So this would seem, Stephen, to put the lie to the notion that these blue states that have very tight gun laws have higher death rates by guns. It seems to be the opposite, that the more loose your gun laws, the higher number of deaths by gun you're going to see in your state. Is that true?
Right. Well, the first thing I would point out there is you're talking about gun deaths and not gun murders, which is, again, yeah, 2/3 of those are going to be suicides. And so the solution is, again, another area where the solution for gun murder and the solution for gun suicide are going to be very different.
Sure.
Most likely. And so, you know, that's one thing to point out with these sorts of rankings that you see from the gun control groups. Everytown did a similar one recently as well. And I would also point out that it doesn't necessarily correlate, especially gun murders versus, you know, the gun control rankings for which states they feel have the best gun laws. And oftentimes the argument you'll get in response to this problem, like, for instance, Washington, D.C. Has far more gun violence than Virginia, even though Virginia has far fewer gun restrictions, even with the new restrictions that were passed recently here in the state. And oftentimes the argument will be that, well, it's because Virginia fuels the violence in D.C., which frankly is sort of specious in my mind, because if Virginia is the problem, Virginia's gun laws are the problem, why doesn't Virginia have the same gun violence issue that Maryland or DC has?
Good point.
And then they'll often also argue that in states like, for instance, Vermont, that have looser gun laws than most of the rest of New England, they also have low crime rates, and they'll argue that those low crime rates in Vermont are the result of the surrounding states having stricter gun laws. So you kind of get this situation where they're sort of cherry picking the logic here, in my opinion. And I personally, I'll let Mike respond here in a second. I just personally, I think it's more complicated. There's a lot of things that go into why a state has high violence rates or low violence rates, and it's not just whatever their gun laws happen to be, because you'll get the same argument from some pro-gun people as well, that you know, the states that have or areas that have more guns or lesser gun regulation have lower crime than, you know, rural areas have less crime than cities do, even though most cities have stricter gun laws than rural areas. And it's more complicated than that in real life, I think.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, I think also, you know, as you're pointing out, comparing Virginia, for example, to D.C. is not apples to apples. I mean, there are entirely different social factors that play in a city like the District of Columbia or even in New York. Having said that, even in New York, with the exception of the last 2 years in which we had a once in a lifetime pandemic, before that happened, gun crime in New York City was low, especially for a city of 8 million people for many years. I mean, post the high homicide rates of the 80s and early 90s, the city was like an exceptionally safe place to live until 2 years ago. It's still fairly safe. I mean, gun homicide has risen, still substantially lower than the high rates of its worst periods, which is worth pointing out. It is also, we've never lived in a country where we have any uniformity of law when it comes to guns anyway. So it's like when we talk about Chicago, I mean, you know, it's a city can enforce whatever ordinances it wants, but it's not like it lives on it's like a city's like got a wall around it, it's an island, it's next to Indiana. It's got neighboring outstate areas that have different gun cultures than the city does. I mean, it's not, there's no way to, you know, whatever law you impose, there's obviously, the problem is like, how do you choke off trafficking into areas that are prone to having high rates of gun violence, and ask why those areas have high rates of gun does. Usually they do, right? Because of a number of social factors that I think we've sort of briefly touched on, whether it be like lack of industry, poverty, historical segregation, redlining, all these things that have created problems within cities that have never really been addressed, systemic factors that have never been touched or addressed meaningfully. That sort of, it is that combined with easy access to firearms that creates centers where there are high rates of gun violence.
All right, so let me ask you this. Let me zoom out for a minute, okay? Because what I've concluded now after this show is we're up Schitt's Creek without a paddle, as they say. We already have, the country is swimming in guns. It's a gun culture. It just is. It has been since its founding. And we mere mortals who find ourselves living in 2022, there's not much we can do about it. It was this way for hundreds of years before we got here, and it remains this way now. Practically, realistically, we're not going to change that. And so I don't see the solution to homicide rates or mass shootings as crackdowns on the guns. It's not to say we couldn't change things at the edges. So understanding that that's the best we could hope for in terms of the guns. And again, the mental health discussion is a whole other discussion, which we'll have to have on another show, because that's an area in which I really do think we could make a difference. But, once somebody's crazed and wants to murder another person, or never mind a mass murder, really hard to stop them by taking away this weapon or that. You know, you can use a car, you can use a knife. We've seen it in London. We've seen it in Waukesha. You want to kill a lot of people. There are a lot of ways to do it. So anyway, if I said to you this, Stephen, you get to choose one, right? As like, do you have kids?
I don't right now.
Okay,
but you care about loved ones.
Certainly. Yeah, exactly. So you care about your family or whatever. You can choose one reform that you think will make the greatest difference in cutting down on the gun homicide rate, the gun mass shooting rate. What would it be?
Probably stricter enforcement of current laws combined with community violence interruption programs. I think those two things could be make a real difference. I mean, and I understand the pessimism, but I would point out that, as Mike alluded to earlier, the murder rate used to be much higher in this country than it is now. Even after this,
but it's creeping.
Recently. So there are
it's
ways
creeping.
To.
Well, to your point, stricter enforcement of laws, and of course, the country's going in the opposite way right now with these soft on crime DAs. These cops. We kicked off the show with these two poor cops who got murdered by this suspect Friday night, and what happened in New York? That used to get you the death penalty. Boom, you kill a cop, you're facing the chair. Period. End of report. No longer. The new DA, Alvin Bragg, is not going to enforce a bunch of laws that are already on the books. He's not allowed to do that. It's not the same as prosecutorial discretion. He's changing the law with the stroke of his pen. I'm not saying that this guy shot the cops because he knew he wouldn't be getting the death penalty, but he won't be getting the death penalty because this guy changed the laws. We're going softer on crime. I do think it has a factor in the higher crime rates that we're seeing. But can you just speak to, before I give it to Mike for his one thing, the violence intervention? So we haven't touched that, and I've read some of your articles on it.
Yeah, violence interruption programs are actually one of those areas where you probably would see a lot of agreement as well, because they aren't focused on trying to ban certain guns or restrict ownership by law-abiding people or anything like that. And it also isn't using necessarily law enforcement tactics to try and stop shootings. Instead, it focuses on using community leaders and providing community support to the small number of people who tend to be the ones most at risk to actually commit these sorts of violent acts, because it's not like, even in a large city, it's not a lot of people generally who are out there committing these shooters. It's a small group of people. And if you can intervene with somebody that they respect, perhaps you can create a situation that off ramps that tension and reduces the potential for violence. And you have seen some studies that indicate this approach has worked, and you're actually seeing some funding being directed towards this without much pushback from or any pushback really from gun rights advocates, because it doesn't interfere with someone's lawful person's ability to own firearms.
Okay, go ahead, Mike. One thing.
I think that's sensible. Setting aside societal factors and root causes, which I think we were just touching on, if I had to pick one specific gun policy, I think that I would focus again on gun dealers specifically. If we're talking seriously about combating everyday gun violence, then I think that means better regulation of gun shops and not allowing dealers to openly flout restrictions, doing a better job with inspections, not letting dealers that are posing serious red flags off with repeated warnings, requiring dealers to better secure their wares in such a way that it's more difficult to steal them in large numbers. I think those are the guns that end up going to the places that deal with gun violence on like a daily basis. So if that's what we really care about, because mass shootings are horrible in the sense that they live in our imagination, they upset the social contract, they cause like widespread fear, but again, are ultimately still a minuscule percentage of overall gun death and shooting, then I think that makes the most sense. Obviously, the guns that are already out there, that's a horse out of the barn situation. And
I like both of your suggestions. I will say one other thing on the part of the media. In these mass shootings, there's a responsibility to report that it happened. There is absolutely no responsibility to keep it on the news on loop day after day after day. That is becoming part of the problem. It's one of the reasons why I don't say the names of mass shooters, and I haven't for more than a decade. Read Gavin DeBecker's book, The Gift of Fear. He's an expert in this area, and he's been arguing for decades. Do not inadvertently or advertently glorify any mass shooter. And I do think it helps. It sends a message to the next one. You'll get nothing. No one's going to know your name. No one's going to give two anything about you. And I don't know. I just think the media can play a role in being more helpful in stopping some of it. Not all of it, sadly. Guys, thank you so much. I learned a lot and I really enjoyed our discussion.
Thanks for having me. Me too.
Appreciate it. See you later, Stephen. See you, Mike. Okay, so don't forget to tune into the show tomorrow because we're going to have more on the latest breaking news. Justice Breyer retiring later this year. That, and we'll have Matt Walsh. Very excited to have Matt Walsh back on the show. In the meantime, download the show as a podcast on Apple, Pandora, Spotify, or Stitcher. Leave me a comment on the Apple comments if you would. Download at youtube.com/MeganKelly. You can subscribe. We appreciate it. Thanks for listening to The Megyn Kelly Show. No BS, no agenda, and no fear.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.